Oye, oye, oye. All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and its Honorable Court. Be seated, please. Case number 06-3150, United States of America versus Newitt, Vincent Ford, appellant. Mr. Kirsch for the appellant, Mr. Ambrosino for the appellee.
Good morning. May it please the court, Stephen Kirsch on behalf of appellant Newitt Ford. As the court is aware from reviewing the pleadings and reviewing the underlying record, Mr. Newitt was one of 15 individuals who was indicted in a massive conspiracy that was centered in the Congress Parks section of the District of Columbia. Prior to trial, Mr. Ford was able to get his case severed from his other co-defendants. And we went to trial in June of 2006. The first count of the indictment was the conspiracy. The two other counts related to individual drug transactions, one in March of 2001, one in April of 2001, both of which were testified to by Special Agent Lockhart and government cooperating witness Mr. Campbell.
And both of them were overt acts in the conspiracy?
Yes, they're both substantive counts and they're both overt acts. But then we had three convictions, two from 1997, one from 1999, that were overt acts but were not indicted counts in the conspiracy. Those were also included as part of the government's proffer of proof. Our argument on appeal is that the government did not have enough evidence to establish that Mr. Ford was a participant in the underlying conspiracy.
Is that really just for count one then?
Yes, that's correct.
So in terms of practical effect, because there's a 240-month sentence on count two and three, we're talking about 22 additional months here, right?
Well, yes, except that our position is that if the conspiracy count did not go forward, if the judge had ruled that the conspiracy didn't go forward, then the other underlying counts would have been affected. It was the combination of you had the conspiracy count on one hand, and then you had five separate individual drug transactions that were considered to be overt acts in the indictment. And the combination or conflating all of that into one indictment was enormously prejudicial to Mr. Ford. And that's why we asked for a pretrial hearing to determine whether or not the government even had enough evidence to go forward on the conspiracy count. And I understand that in this circuit, we do not follow the rule of the Fifth Circuit of United States versus James, where the appellate court said that the trial court can hold a hearing. It didn't mandate it, but it said it can hold a hearing to determine whether or not there's enough evidence to go forward on the conspiracy count. there's no, that I could find, prohibition against doing that in the district court. But what the rule has been is that...
We have two opinions, right? Jackson and Guin, both of which accept this, and if anything, they're somewhat more liberal than the Bourgeois case in the Supreme Court, which permitted everything to come in based on, or at least didn't decide whether it was barred to use co-conspirator statements to prove the conspiracy. So is your position that we should establish a new precedent that there must be a preliminary hearing?
No, on
whether they're sufficient for conspiracy?
No, I wouldn't go that far, but I would say it should be analyzed on a case-by-case basis.
So what makes it an abuse in this case? I mean, you have tried, I know, many conspiracy cases, all of which look like this. That is, all of which have substantive counts, have the substantive counts be overt acts. Are you taking the position in every one of those kind of cases there has to be a preliminary hearing? Or put it another way, that's an abuse of discretion not to have it.
I think that in a case like this, and I analogize this case to Cooper, which we cited in our pleadings, they were both single defendant cases, and I think that's what stands out. Whereas in Edelin, you had six defendants, you had 70 some odd counts, and Judge Lambert said, well, we can't have a preliminary hearing because it's too overwhelming. It takes too long, it delays the trial. Those are his considerations. He didn't say it was redundant, but he said it's just the logistics of doing this before trial just don't make any sense because it's prejudicial to the government having to reveal so much against so much defendants. But both in this case and in Cooper, there were, slip of the tongue,
yes.
There were, I didn't mean that, there was single defendants. Now, in Cooper, Judge Green denied the motion for pretrial hearing, but in Cooper, that was a racketeering case, it was a murder case, it was an armed robbery case. I believe there were 48 separate counts in the indictment. And what she said in Cooper, what Judge Green said in Cooper, was that, well, it just takes too much time and it's going to be a delay of the trial. In this limited situation, you have one defendant and the government had four witnesses, and they could have cut down their testimony on direct examination just to talk about, is there enough evidence for us to go forward on the conspiracy? And my position is that there was not enough evidence because it was lacking in all of the indicia that that courts of appeals, including this court, have said what you needed in
but
order
now,
to
But now that we have the entire record, no preliminary hearing, but now we've gone all the way through and we have the entire record, and if it were the case that we concluded that there is sufficient evidence, what's the consequence of there not having been a preliminary hearing?
Oh, if the court concludes that there was sufficient evidence, there is no practical consequence to Mr. Ford because we don't have a rule mandating
a hearing. But even if there were a rule mandating the hearing and we then went through and found there was sufficient evidence, it would be harmless to have failed to have held the preliminary hearing.
I think that's correct. I don't disagree with the court on that. But I don't believe that's what we have here because what's lacking here is there was no testimony about coordinating of efforts. There was no testimony about sharing of profits among the different people. There was no testimony about different roles. This person's role is A, this person's role is B. Ford was acting laissez-faire. He was out there on his own. He was, by the government's evidence, purchasing drugs from Burke Johnson and then selling them on his own. One of the witnesses says, well, I saw him selling drugs to some prostitutes in front of a house on Savannah Street. Okay, he's doing that on his own. He's not doing that as part of a conspiracy. I understand the government doesn't have to prove a structure or a hierarchy, but if they did have evidence of a structure or a hierarchy, it enhances their record. It suggests that there is something going on other than this individual.
Why wasn't there a structure where Johnson was the main player and there were a bunch of people who were supplied by Johnson?
Wheel and spoke. Yeah. Why isn't that what you have? Wheel and spoke. You seem like you just described wheel and spoke conspiracy.
Except that Ford had no knowledge of what Johnson was doing.
Well, he saw Johnson.
We're selling on the street, weren't they?
He saw Johnson making the packets. He saw.
Well, he had a buyer-seller relationship with Johnson, but
for others, he was. The testimony from McClendon and was that and Gail Parsons was that he was with the others. I guess it's Boy, Santucci, Jay, right?
And I agree.
Sometimes bought from. I guess it was Boy, Santucci.
I agree that was their testimony. What I argued to the jury when I submit to this court is their testimony had absolutely no credibility. Mary McClendon was a longtime drug addict. She admitted lying to the court.
Can't do much with that.
Well, I understand that, but I think that when the trial judge has to view the totality of the evidence, and I understand that the credibility determinations are made by the jury, but somebody like Mary McClendon, who just came in and flat out lied and said, I never sold drugs, and then was impeached with her plea agreement where she said she sold drugs. And when Gail Parsons comes in and identifies 21 people in the proffer of evidence who were involved in selling drugs and being part of this community of people selling drugs and doesn't mention the name Newitt Ford, that their credibility is so lacking. There's nothing that the court can go on and say, well, I accept that because it's believable. It's not believable. And the government doesn't raise their testimony in their brief. Government relies on Burke Johnson, and I believe that that's the appropriate way to go because I think we can really discount what McClendon said, and we can discount what Gail Parsons said.
Ask you about you make an argument about prior crimes evidence, which I take it out of the second two charges. If we find that there was sufficient evidence for a conspiracy, then this is not prior crimes at all. This is the crime, right?
I agree.
Okay, so there's no 404B issue if it is a conspiracy.
Exactly. Everything flows from whether or not the government's established is there a conspiracy.
Okay.
And that was our motion for judgment of acquittal.
Okay.
And if you have any other questions, I'll reserve the rest of my time.
Very good. Thank you very much, Mr. Kirsch. We'll hear from the government.
Good morning, Your Honor. Michael Ambrosino of the United States. I'm joined at council table by Roy McLeese and Ann Patalis, trial counsel. Viewing the evidence in the light most favorable to the United States, a jury could have reasonably found that appellant knew it Ford knowingly participated in the conspiracy to sell crack cocaine within Congress Park. The conspiracy that was alleged in the superseding indictment was very plain and clear. It was very simple. It had a goal of one thing, and that was to sell crack cocaine within this confined area known as Congress Park. There was a number of factors that demonstrated to the jury that appellant knowingly participated in this conspiracy. One, he purchased his crack cocaine, his product, from other co-conspirators, namely Burke Johnson, but also from Santus.
I mean, every time there's a distributor, somebody's charged with distribution, that you can also charge them with conspiracy because he had to get the drugs someplace?
No, Your Honor. I think you have to look at the evidence in its totality and in conjunction with all the factors.
We usually do look at all the evidence. So what does that mean? That doesn't tell me anything.
Well,
what's the test?
That's just the first factor. And I think the test would be, is looking at the evidence in the light most favorable to the government. Could a jury reasonably find that he knowingly participated in this conspiracy?
Well, I thought you might say something like, well, you know, just because the guy's distributing, maybe has a supplier here, a supplier there, there's not a continuity of a relationship, there's just a business transaction. I'm trying to figure out if it's not true that every time a distributor of drugs engages in that offense, the person necessarily is also engaging in a conspiracy because he got the drugs from somebody else. I'm looking to what's the test for separating it out?
In this circumstance where you have something akin to a spoken wheel, I think the test is looking, is there circumstantial evidence from which a jury could reasonably conclude that this co-conspirator was aware of the other co-conspirators and their relationship to the person in the center, i.e., Burke Johnson, and what you have here to establish that.
I suppose there wasn't such evidence, and suppose that the only evidence really was between Ford and Johnson. Is that still why isn't that a conspiracy? It only takes two.
It could be, Your Honor. It could be a conspiracy between those two. That's not what was alleged, nor was it what was proven.
Nor was it what you put all that great co-conspirator evidence in about. So you've got to have a better conspiracy than just those two, or
that's true. And here we have that, and we have Johnson not facilitating appellant directly, and also facilitating the others, and directly facilitating appellant by helping him secret his drugs, teaching him how to secret his drugs from the police, vouching for his product even when Johnson's not the supplier. You have him allowing him to be present when he's cutting up and distributing the drugs and packaging the drugs for distribution. That's something that this circuit and other circuits as well placed a lot of emphasis on, because drug dealers don't invite people in to their secret manufacturing facilities.
You have to show, we've held in the Drug and Spoke, you have to show interdependence, right? You have to show some reason why the defendants understand that they share a common goal and that they depend on each other, right? So what's the evidence of that? That's what I think Judge Randolph is asking you. What's the evidence, not just one buyer, one seller, but that this particular person understands objectively, not subjectively, that the other players are key to his own success?
Well, I think there's five factors. He's being supplied by co-conspirators, and he's being supplied by people in that area. He's allowed to sell in that area, and the evidence is this is a closed-off cul-de-sac where outsiders aren't welcome. You're only welcome to sell there. In fact, they talk, appellant's brief talks about how one of the people who was unwelcome there was actually even chased out. So he's allowed to sell there. He's selling there next to other co-conspirators such as Boy Boy, Santus, Jay, Jazz. And he specifically sells for Burke Johnson on occasion. He's not just purchasing from him, but he's actually selling his product when he's not purchasing it. He's out there working for him.
Was Burke Johnson the only supplier in this Congress Park?
No, in fact, the evidence was Johnson testified that appellant himself was also supplied by Boy Boy, Santus, and Joe Langley, and that he would, in fact, vouch for his product. And here's another example of interdependence. He would actually vouch for appellant's product when he bought from Boy Boy and Santucci because he was confident in the quality of that product. But there's also interdependence shown by the fact that he's allowing him in when this product is being cut up and packaged. And this circuit and the other circuits have affirmed convictions where that's really the only piece of the puzzle. You have people involved there in the manufacturing part of it. Now, the evidence here, to be candid, was not that he was participating in cutting it up and packaging, but he's invited in. He's allowed to see where these drugs are being hidden. And this isn't just the amount that's being sold to appellant. Burke Johnson talked about how he was going out and buying large quantities of cocaine for other members of the co-conspiracy, such as some of the other high-level players. He named four of them in the evidence. And so it was fair for the jury to infer from that these were large quantities of crack cocaine that were being cut up and packaged, and appellant was allowed in. He was allowed to know where this was being done. At Burke Johnson's mother's house and at two other locations, he named two other locations where appellant would be present when it wasn't just when the cocaine was being packaged for appellant himself. Johnson was very clear that he would be present even when it was being packaged for others. And so when you look at all of those factors in conjunction, really the only reasonable inference that a jury could draw from that is that within the confines of this closed-off cul-de-sac...
You don't want to make that our standard of review, that the only reasonable conclusion...
No, I think this goes beyond what the standard of review is. I think this is very strong evidence. And the only other remark I'd make, Your Honors, is that with respect to the interdependence, is that Johnson himself acted with no fewer than 11 of the co-conspirators in one function or another, whether he was buying for them, selling to them, or having them actually go out and move his product. And when appellant was the one moving his product on the street, not where appellant would actually purchase what he called 8 balls or 1/4 ounces from him, but where appellant was actually out there moving Burke Johnson's product on the street, he would be selling between $800 and $900 a day of dime bags. So he's selling between 80 or 90 dime bags throughout the day. Again, the really only fair inference that a jury could draw from that is that there's some type of profit sharing going on there. I acknowledge that it was not explicitly elicited from that witness, but there's certainly no evidence, and it wouldn't be reasonable for a jury to hear that evidence and say, well, maybe he was just doing that because they were friends. Obviously, this is a long-term drug dealer who's out there for a decade or so. He's out there for profit, and there's some kind of profit sharing. At least that's certainly a fair inference that the jury could draw from that evidence. And lastly, with respect to the prejudice, I would point out two factors to the court. Judge Roberts went to great lengths here to ensure fairness for the for this appellant. He severs him out prior to the overarching conspiracy, which I would submit to Your Honors is fairly unusual. I don't know if I've ever seen that in one of these large RICO and drug conspiracy cases. And so what that had the effect of doing is the conspiracy then goes from 137 overt acts down to just 5 overt acts. And all 5 of those overt acts involve not just the distribution of crack, but involve distribution of crack by this appellant himself. And that's a far cry from 137 overt acts, many of which involved murder and other serious acts of violence. I mean, there you're going to have a much stronger prejudice argument, spillover prejudice argument, than you're going to have when the judge takes this appellant out, severs them, and has the government issue a superseding indictment or seek a superseding indictment that is pared down to really focus upon appellant's drug activity. And that's what happened here. And the second factor that I would note in terms of prejudice is that both of these buys are both videotaped and audiotaped, and they're corroborated by the fact that they're not only witnessed by Agent Lockhart, but the undercover buyer is searched prior to each buy, and then the purchased narcotics are recovered and tested and confirmed to be crack cocaine. So the evidence in those cases, those two distributions, is so overwhelming that it would be, I think.
You don't have to charge overt acts in the indictment, do you?
Not in a drug conspiracy. What about a RICO conspiracy? You don't in a drug conspiracy.
Right.
What about?
I've never seen an indictment without them, but I'm not sure whether you have to. I've always seen goal, ways, and means, and overt acts. But in this case, again, the overt acts were, of course, limited to appellant himself. And if the court has no other questions, I'd ask that the judgment below be affirmed.
Thank you.
Thank you.
How much time does Mr. Kirsch have?
Actually, I do believe that in a RICO that the government does have to.
In a RICO, but not in a drug.
But not in a conspiracy.
Not in a Title 21.
That's correct. In response to questions that Judge Randolph raised between how do you determine the distinction between a buyer-seller relationship as opposed to conspiracy, I think that question was answered by this court in United States versus Baum, which was decided in 2006. And some of the factors in Baum are directly applicable here. They said one of the factors is knowledge of the buyer's intent. So here, there's no information that Mr. Ford had any knowledge of what the buyer's intent was.
Well, you can infer the intent from the quantity in the package.
Yes, you can. And here you had quantities of 2.6 grams.
Twice a month.
Right. But they were small amounts. Right. You had whether or not it wasn't required that they establish a larger organization, but if there is a larger organization that's established, that shows that it's more of a conspiracy than a buyer-seller. That wasn't the case here. The importance of the buyer to the seller. And here, Mr. Ford was low level. I don't think anybody disputes that. I don't think that he had any great significance to anybody, particularly Burke Johnson, who was involved in large-scale drug activities. And then the issue of whether or not there's credit. And Burke Johnson said, well, maybe once or twice I advanced some drugs to Mr. Ford for credit. But it wasn't a regular basis. And I'd also direct.
There are other factors in Baum, though, the duration and regularity of the dealings.
That's
duration
correct.
was long here.
Well, but you do have this big break from 1999 to 2001, and then there's another break in the chain. Okay. But I would direct the court also to United States versus Carson. And in Carson, what the court talked about, and I think what the court emphasized, is that the government established that there was this rotation system where they're out on K Street selling drugs and that they were rotating through. So at one point, one person was at the corner, the next person, another was at the corner, and that it was a coordinated effort to rotate, which demonstrated planning and it demonstrated an intent to share the profits that they had. And that's what the court focused on in finding that there was a conspiracy in that case.
Thank you. Mr. Kirsch, you were appointed by the court to represent the appellant. And the court thanks you very much for your assistance. Excellent as always. We appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.